No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
Good evening. That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions in. Maria, how are you? We missed Senator, you last week. I'm sorry, I'm a little disjointed. I'm trying to do three things at the same time.
But. I'm sure. And this is our first broadcast together after standard time, so that's an adjustment. And then now having two of my four children be married has been a wonderful adjustment because, as you mentioned prior to the show, I now have two daughter-in-laws, a daughter, and three sons. So my family continues to grow, and they all do it the old-fashioned way. There's no baby on board. Which, no problem with that. But yeah, we're a little old fashioned. So I'm happy with that too. So thank you for asking. And I apologize for being gone, but it was time well served.
Yeah, well, yeah, you've got two down and two to go.
Correct.
You know, that my grandmother used to say, you know, you had to be married for 2 years before you had a kid, because that way the relatives on the West Coast, you know, got, you know what I mean? It was, she didn't like any gray area. So
well, and my mom would say that everyone's running through their fingers like on the rosary.
Yeah.
Counting the months.
Exactly. That's the way my mom would have been. You know, my mom, who was the world's worst driver, used to do her rosary in the car while she was driving. It wasn't bad enough that she was a bad driver. Then she would do her rosary while she was driving. Anyway, we have a great guest tonight.
Yes.
We have Mark Gerzen, who's written a book called, what is it called? Mark, please come on the show. Tell me the name of the book again. The Reunited States of America. Is that correct? Mark, are you there?
That's the Reunited States of America.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. I'm sorry. My notes are a little hazy today. But, you know, this is such an important subject, Mark, and we're so excited to have you on the show because, you know, we've never been more divided. We've just had a presidential election, as you know, so let's start at the top. Joe Biden got 75 million votes. That's the most votes ever cast for a presidential candidate. But Donald Trump got the second most votes ever cast for a presidential candidate. It ended up being approximately 51% to 48%. So we couldn't be any more divided than we are right now. And, you know, the map hasn't really changed much since 2016. We're at approximately the same. Trump got 47.72, President Trump. And in 2016, he got 46.4% of the vote. So we're still in pretty much the same place we've been for the past 4 years. So how do we move ahead?
Well, I think the main way we move ahead is to ask ourselves what's in our best interest. And my experience as an American for the last 70 years is that what's in our best interest is when Democrats and Republicans work together and solve the problems that affect me and my family. That's what's good for me. What's not good for me is political paralysis And that's political paralysis, you know, on domestic issues, political paralysis on international issues, and then making second-rate decisions and developing second-rate policies because these leaders of ours refuse to get along. So that's my short answer. You know, that's my short answer, Senator. We need the two parties to work together. And it's a relationship. So, you know, on November 3rd, it's all about who wins. On November 4th, it's about, okay, let's get the job done. And I think we're missing that second part of the American leadership ethos.
Well, we certainly see that, and we see it today. We've got Republicans out there right now that are refusing to, get along. I guess you've got people like Lindsey Graham out there saying we're going to fight this, and Rudolph Giuliani and these other people. So, what do we do about these guys? How do we bring people together? I mean, there is this feeling out there, and it's palpable that the bad guys are on the other side. Right? The Republicans think the Democrats are bad guys and vice versa. So how do we ameliorate that? How do we get around that? Do you have any ideas on that?
Well, I do. And the United States of America, when I wrote it, and also the film that's coming out about it, is basically all about people who are actually doing that. So I'm glad to give you my opinion, but just want you to know my opinion is based on the 40 or more people who I write about in the United States of America, and it's also based on the people in the film, and it's based on the people who are part of the 100 organizations that we have put together, an organization called the Bridge Alliance. So there's a whole movement of Americans, so I'm glad to describe them and tell you my ideas, but I've got to tell you, my ideas come from this movement, and what I'm trying to do is shine a light, and I really appreciate you and Maria shining a light on this third way of being an active citizen, because right now in America, we have two narratives. The one first narrative is I'm a Republican and Democrats, you know, are the problem. And the other is I'm a Democrat and Republicans are the problem. Those two narratives, you know, we hear about, we have conventions for, we've got entire networks devoted to those narratives. And there's a third narrative, which is we can't solve problems unless we work together. And I'm a firm believer in that third narrative. And the vote, if I can say so, you know, kind of proves that point. The vote was 75 million to 70 million. That's not exactly what you'd call a landslide. And right. If it had gone the other way, I'd be saying exactly the same thing. We have a divided country. And the metaphor I like to use, it's a simple one, is let's say you have oars and I have a boat, and we're standing on the shore and there's some kids drowning. Well, I think it's a moral imperative for us to put your oars and my boat together and go rescue those kids who are drowning. And what we have now is a nation that's drowning. You know, drowning in climate change, drowning in debt, drowning in unemployment, drowning in COVID, drowning in crises. And we need the two parties to get together and solve those problems. And so the first thing really is to say, you know, is to really look at it and say, do either of those groups, the 75 million or the 70 million, think that the other group is going to disappear? I mean, I've watched election after election, so have you, and they're not going to disappear. They're going to be here next time. They're not going away, you know. Maybe if it was 25 people or 100 people, you could say, gee, I wish they'd go back to wherever they came from. We're talking about 70 million people, half the country, or 75 million people. So we are in a relationship. And I've done a lot of couples coaching and family coaching. I was originally trained as a family therapist before I became a mediator. And the bottom line is, if you're in a long-term relationship, the question is, are you going to make each other miserable? Or are you going to make something out of it for you and those you love? And I think that's the stage we're at, and I'm glad to get into specifics. But to me, it's absolutely essential that we see it as a relationship and not one as winners and losers. On election day, it's winners and losers. Every other day of the year, it's about a relationship.
Well, you know, before I let Maria ask you a question, let me tell you that one of the reasons I was excited to have you on the show is this is exactly why the show was founded almost right. 7 years ago. And this is why Maria is a Republican on the West Coast and I'm a Democrat on the East Coast, was to show America that we have more in common than what separates us. Maria, I'm sorry. I don't mean to monopolize.
No worries. And Mark, first of all, again, welcome and thank you for making us a part of your life, because we're deeply in gratitude towards you for what you've done with the Mediators Foundation, which I'd like to ask you about, but also want to give our listeners a little background that you've been involved in global affairs. When you were junior at Harvard, you lived and studied in 7 countries around the world. Then you were a journalist. You co-World Paper, which is a global newspaper, and reached a circulation of 1.5 million people in 5 languages. Then you were a citizen diplomat. You worked for several years bringing together Soviet and American civic leaders to help end the Cold War. And now you're also a United Nations advisor in leadership development. So you have a lot of gravitas in your opinions, because not only have you worked for it, you've earned it and you've lived it. So tell us first, if you don't mind, what the Mediators Foundation means to you and why you founded it over 25 years ago.
Well, it goes right to the heart of our current conversation, Maria, in the sense that I thought back in the 80s, as we had nuclear weapons pointed at each other, the Soviet Union pointed at us and us pointed ours at them, I thought, you know, this is crazy, you know. Our future as a species, my children's future is at risk because we have these nuclear weapons pointed at each other. Can't we find a better way of disagreeing? And so Mediators Foundation, as the name suggests, was named to be a bridge between different sides and also to use the media to do that. So what you're both doing with this show is exactly why I started Mediators. And I worked in Hollywood for a number of years trying to create film and television products that were really about building bridges, because I think the media is the best way to build a bridge. You know, it's that you can bring two households together on the screen. One who's a red family, one who's a blue family, and say, come to my show and let's talk together. And you can put them on the screen together, you can put them in the show together, and they can talk to each other. So I'm a firm believer in what we're doing here today, Marie, and that's why I started Mediators now almost 30 years ago.
Let me say that this is one of the reasons that Maria is so important to the show. I couldn't pull up your bio on my computer because of a glitch. And Maria, thank you for letting our audience know exactly who we're talking to. I apologize. Usually we start the show with your bio, but
no
thanks
worries.
For being on top of it, Maria.
Of course. And then could we mention too, Mark, about your projects? Because there's dozens of them, it seems.
Well, and the one I think that might interest your listeners the most is that, back in the 1990s, the last time that the United States Congress actually wanted to work together, we had what they called the Congressional Bipartisan Retreats. And I was hired to design those retreats. So I worked intimately with the Democrats and Republicans in the House of Representatives. I took more than 250 of them and their spouses away for a weekend to Hershey, Pennsylvania. And the entire weekend was devoted to building a stronger relationship so they could do better work for the American people. And when I tell that story now, 20 years later, it sounds like almost like a fairy tale, you know, because they haven't done that for 20 years. They haven't even tried. And the metaphor that I'd like to share with you is that I feel like I witnessed firsthand the red light go on the dashboard of democracy. And the red light said, you know, add oil. And that happened. Add oil happened in the 90s. Well, we never added oil to the dash. You know, we never added oil to the vehicle we call democracy, and now it's breaking down. And I'm using that metaphor intentionally because, to me, it says to anybody who's listening to this, what does it mean to add oil to the engine of democracy? And I think if the engine, that to me, the oil is collaboration, is trust, is respect, and without that, you know, we're going to see what we're seeing now—a breakdown in democracy. So what Joe Biden called for in his a speech on earlier this weekend, what he called for was basically, like you said, let's put oil in the engine of democracy. I've been saying that for 25 years, and I'm really glad to have this chance to discuss it with both of you.
Did we put a little more oil in this election because almost 150 million people voted? Does that help oil the democracy, or is that not relevant? We're still so divided.
Well, I think it's great. The level of participation is great because it says people care. But when people really care and they're divided, that can lead to rapprochement, it can lead to war. It really depends on how is all that energy channeled. So I'm all in favor of the enthusiasm and the passion on both sides. I'm all in favor of people caring enough to go vote. I happen to be a sports fan, and it is Sunday football now. So I'll use a metaphor, which is, you know, we are great in America having clear rules for our football games and our basketball games. We are fantastic. We very rarely have violence around our games. And why is that? Even when our people are passionately for the Steelers or the 49ers or whoever, we don't have violence because people trust the system. And they're sad when their team loses and they're excited when their team wins. But they know they can trust the refs. They know they can trust, you know, the chalk lines. They know they can trust the scorekeepers. And I wish we cared as much about our civic institutions as we care about our sporting events. Because if you look at it, I feel we don't trust our refs anymore. We're confused about the rules. The refs are often, you know, we're worried that they've been bought off by one team or the other. People aren't calling fouls and there's a lot of concern about whether the scorekeeping is accurate. So to me as a sports fan, it's like, hey guys, you know, let's care as much about this country we say we love as we care about our Sunday football game.
It's a great analogy. You know, Ben Franklin said that war happens when the government tells you who the bad guy is. Revolution happens when you decide that for yourself. Have we decided, have we gotten to that point? Or are we on the brink of social revolution here in America?
Well, we are, but the reason I stress this third narrative is that, you know, I mean, I'll just again use an analogy if I can, that, you know, I remember the day when if you wanted to get a ride somewhere and you needed to hire it, you called Yellow Cab. And you needed to call a cab company, you know.
You are an old guy.
Yeah, there is no such thing as Uber. And there was no such thing as Lyft, you know. And so now people, you know, there's still a Yellow Cab somewhere in New York City, but people call Uber, they call Lyft. Well, they realized there was a better other way. That was called innovation. The phone that I'm talking to you was invented by the Apple, you know, an Apple company. It's an innovation. We're an innovative country. So it seems to me that if we're able to innovate, why can't we innovate on how we vote? Why can't we innovate on a lot of these issues where people say, well, there's the left point of view and there's the right point of view. And I hope in this hour we can go at a couple of issues and talk about what does innovation look like as opposed to argumentation, right? Argumentation is stale, bored, tired thinking. And innovation is saying, let's do something new around this. And to me, that's the exciting part, because when Steve Jobs created the iPhone, he did it by putting teams at war with each other and said, you guys, invent a phone, try different styles, fight with each other, and I'll look at the different versions, and then we'll put together the best one we can. So I wish we could do that with healthcare. I wish we could do that with immigration. I wish we could do that with so many things. Let's try different approaches to solving a problem, and then let's all use the best solution we can find. That's the American spirit. We bring it to our business, but we don't bring it to our politics.
Yeah.
That's true. Suggest in the Reunited States of America, which the subtitle is How We Can Bridge the Partisan Divide, that there are people who are doing it now, bridging that partisan divide. Can you share Absolutely. With us what that looks like and how it is that they're successful and where they started?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, one of the best examples is what my colleague Van Jones and Newt Gingrich, what they did around criminal justice reform. Liberals and conservatives got together and they realized that they had totally different reasons for wanting the same thing. They both wanted criminal justice reform. The conservatives wanted it because they were noticing that this entire costly enterprise was killing a lot of states. They were just spending fortunes on criminal justice, and they were getting absolutely lousy returns. So from their business-oriented perspective, it was like, boy, this criminal justice system really is one of the most inefficient things the government does. Liberals were looking at it and they're going, it's really unjust. We've put people away for 20, 30, 40 years for a drug offense. We threw away the key, and some really productive, creative people are instead, you know, costing us, you know, $100,000 a year to put in a jail. So for different reasons, they came together, and it was because people like Newt Gingrich and Van Jones built a coalition across the divide. And Van Jones very skillfully went to Jared Kushner and others, and they built this cross-partisan coalition around criminal justice reform. And it's one of the few things in the last 4 years that actually got done. And it got done because people practiced what we're talking about, Maria. They practiced crossing the divide. And I think we can do that on almost every issue.
Well, you know, I've said for a long time, Mark, that the best news and the worst news about democracy is the same news, that it represents the people. Mm-hmm. And you say in your book, or you say in your film, before we can fix governments, we need to fix ourselves. And I believe that. So how do we do that? How do we start doing that at the grassroots level,
right,
fixing ourselves?
Well, for me, the first step has been recognizing that I have an inner liberal and I have an inner conservative. And I think if most people who are listening today would be honest, you know, I mean, just like take the two of you. Michael, you're not 100% a liberal, and Maria, you're not 100% a conservative. You're both real people with diverse, right, attitudes on diverse topics. And
sure,
so the problem begins with our map. The problem begins with our map and the fact that we say we're either on the left or the right, we're either conservative or liberal. And I think it's one of the most unjust things we do to ourselves. Because if you prick me on one spot, you're going to find a conservative. If you prick me somewhere else, you're going to find a real liberal. And I'm proud of that because I'm being true to myself. Most of the people I know, it's the same as true. And when I work with Congress, you know, if there's one idea I'd want your listeners to go away with today, is when I work with Congress, what I realized was that, yeah, there were some that were on the left and some that were on the right, but there were also some that wanted to work together and some who didn't. There were some who stereotyped each other, who hated each other and wanted to just to win, and there were others who really, on both sides, who wanted to work together and solve problems. So the notion that left and right is a complete map is absolute horseshit. You know, there's also this whole question of, do you want to work together to solve problems, or do you want to, you know, beat the other side and win? And so my feeling is there's a coalition, a left-right coalition, that's really about problem solving. And I think your show, you know, is kind of a symbol of that. You know, you put the two of you together for the same principle that at the retreats, I asked a Democrat and Republican member of Congress to run each of the breakout rooms. So I created partnerships between this Democrat and this Republican, and that partnership was in charge of each of the 12 breakout rooms at the retreat. Why did I do that? Because partnership is totally missing in the actual way Congress works. Congress works totally about majority and minority. There's never two equal people on a committee. It's always the chair and the co-chair, or the co-chair is always from the minority party.
Minority.
And,
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, I believe we have to be more creative as human beings and just say, hey, there are, it's just what Joe Biden said in his speech. He said, mm-hmm, they're not our enemies. They're not our enemies. They're our opponents. And when you're on a committee, they're actually your potential partner. And if we look at healthcare as an example, I mean, everybody cares about the quality of healthcare. But what we're doing now is we're zigzagging back and forth between what Democrats want and what Republicans want, what Democrats want, what Republicans want. And I mean, it's like that's no way to create a sustainable, efficient healthcare system. If we really want a healthcare system, both sides of the aisle have to work together and say, this is our system we're going to be developing and refining. And of course, who's in power will determine how it shifts one way or the other. But the basic premise has to be settled on, and we have to find, just like Steve Jobs found the best iPhone, can't we find the best healthcare system and stick with it for more than 4 years?
You know, what about respect? One of the reasons, now Maria and I agree on many things, but
a
one
lot
of the reasons,
things.
Yes, but one of the reasons that I'm always willing to listen to what Maria says is because I have great respect for her. I know who she is, and I know, you know, that she's a good person who cares about making a better America. So how do we get to that point? I mean, it seems to me that when you're bringing members of the opposite parties together to get to know each other, that that's really the perfect thing to do. How do we get more of that going on? How do we bring people together to see that, you know, our basic values are so similar? We love our children. We love our country, you know, et cetera, et cetera. How do we do that?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that question about respect, because that was the first ground rule that the members of Congress agreed on for the weekend retreat. We had some ground rules because they said to me, Mark, you know, how do you know we're going to behave differently when you take us off to Hershey, Pennsylvania, we do on Capitol Hill? You know,
right.
They were about to, you know, there were 250 who were getting on a train to go to Hershey, Pennsylvania to behave differently. And they were worried that the whole country was going to laugh at them because they were going to behave the same way there that they do on Capitol Hill. And so months before, I said, well, the only way you're going to behave differently is if there's different ground rules. So they made a set of ground rules. And ground rule number one, Michael, was exactly what you said, R-E-S-P-E-C-T. That was ground rule number one. And every co-chair agreed to enforce that ground rule as well as the other four. And so, you know, it's a question of an agreement. I mean, you know, when two boxers go in the ring, there's an agreement that there's, you know, X number of rounds, that they're going to wear gloves, that you don't hit below the belt. I mean, there's some agreements, you know. There's an agreement in almost every sporting event. We need the agreement that we're going to respect each other. We're going to argue, you know, vociferously and passionately and fiercely our point of view. But there's going to be basic respect for each other. And it's as simple as that. There has to be a ground rule for it. And when people don't do it, and that's why we're in such danger now, when people don't do it, whether it's a president or a senator or your neighbor, there has to be consequences. And there haven't been consequences. All that happens now, if you don't show respect, is you get more people listening to your Twitter feed.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's exactly true. It's sad. Go ahead, Maria.
Yes, I was curious because in the reunited States of America, you list a couple of people that, as you say, you spotlight on them, and it's names that I'm not familiar with. And so I was digging in a little bit to, like, say, Mabel McKinney Browning, and there's not a whole lot available about her other than she wrote textbooks. Is that right?
Well, let me tell you what I would encourage you to do, if you or one of your listeners. Go to the Bridge Alliance, go to bridgealliance.us. And if you go to bridgealliance.us, which is the organization that grew out of the book, you'll find over 100 organizations, including Mabel's. You'll find over 100 organizations that are doing the work we're talking about. I'll just mention a couple so you have an illustration. Allsides.com. If you go to allsides.com, just click it on your computer and go there. You'll find that my friend John Gable, who was an internet guy who worked for the big, you know, big companies, all the, you know, the Facebooks and all the Silicon Valley companies. He was realizing that the internet was actually dividing us, not connecting us. So we started allsides.com. And if you go to allsides.com, you'll find the news from the left, the right, and the center, all on the same site. And it's being used in schools around the country, training young people to go, hey, When the news comes at you, it's often in different forms, in different slants. Become familiar with it. For you to be a good citizen, you actually need to know how to understand those different ways of looking at the news. And it trains young people, or just like it trains us, to understand that people put different slants on the news so that you can think for yourself. And I think for me, the whole first part, the whole first set of organizations I look at in the United States of America are organizations that teach us to be learners. That, you know, I point out that people think that citizens, if you're an active citizen, is somebody who goes and argues for their point of view. And I challenge that. I say, actually, the first task of a citizen is to commit to being a person who learns. Because, you know, I mean, pick any issue. I mean, fracking or you know, whatever is abortion or anything. If you go out and just argue your point of view, it's a very static world out there. And I go out there with the notion of, I want to learn more about fracking. I want to learn more about healthcare reform. I want to learn more about immigration. And then I'll have a point of view, and I'll continue to refine my point of view by talking to people who are different than me and who see it differently, because I want to understand, why do they see it differently? Because, of course, I think I'm right. So I'm mentioning All Sides, Maria, simply because it symbolizes all those organizations out there that are helping us to learn more about the issues. Then I also look at other organizations that are all about relationship, like Living Room Conversations. Joan Blades started an organization called Living Room Conversations, and all across the country, they've gotten communities doing Living Room Conversations where, you know, three or four people invite three or four people who think differently over to their living room. In the pre-COVID era, now they do it online. And they have a conversation about what's affecting their community as if they were sitting together in the living room. So John Gable and Joan Blades are two very simple examples, John Gable being a Republican and Joan Blades being a Democrat, two very simple examples of people who decided, hey, I've got to do something about this. And I'll give you one more example, if I might, Maria. In the film that's coming out in January called The Reunited States, the lead characters in it are a couple from Dallas, Texas, a Republican guy who, you know, used to be a Republican political operative, and his wife, And back in 2016, they're looking at what's going on in the country. They said, this is crazy. I mean, our country is divided. And they asked themselves, well, what can we do about it? We're an ordinary family, you know, three kids living in Dallas, Texas. You know, I'm a former Republican political operative. I've helped put a lot of Democrats out of business. And so I'm not really, I don't, that's not, that didn't help anything. That more of that's not going to help anything. So anyway, they tell their story of, you know, they quit their job. They sold their house. They bought an RV and they traveled to all 50 states, meeting people, bringing people into their RV, sitting with people from different walks of life. And learning about the country, because his wife, you know, David and Aaron Leverton are their names, and it all happened because they heard about my book on the Dallas Public Radio station, but then they sat down for dinner afterwards, and Aaron said to David, well, Aaron, you know, she said, David, how can we love a country if we don't know a country? And David said, well, you're right, we can't. And Aaron said, well, you know, maybe we should go meet the country, and then they did it. They spent a year, more than a year. And I'm so proud of them, and I'm so proud of knowing them, and I'm excited that they're part of this Reunited States film, because they're one of four or five characters that the filmmakers have looked at deeply, people who literally turned their lives inside out because they're taking the questions we're discussing seriously. So John Gable, Joan Blades, Aaron and David Leverton, they're just a few, you know, a few examples. But I'll mention one other who's in the film just to show the range, True Pettigrew. True Pettigrew was a guy who did business consulting in a small, you know, town in North Carolina. He's black. He noticed that there was, you know, more and more black police violence going on. He's got kids. He was scared to raise black kids in a town in North Carolina for fear something would happen to them. So he started bringing together the police and the black community in barbershops and in, you know, community places and in coffee shops and on Zoom and just having them sit together and get to know each other. And the work he did between the police and the black community in his hometown has really made it a safer town and made his kids safer and made the police more comfortable because they've got friends across that they didn't have before. And you know, so True's another example. And I could keep going like this for the rest of the hour. But nice. the bottom line is there's a movement of people like that, and they don't get any attention, which is why I've wrote the book and why I'm so excited that the film's coming out in January, because people need to know that for every, you know, hardcore red Republican and hardcore blue Democrat, there's another 10 or 15 or 20 Americans that are busily crossing the divide, and nobody's paying attention to them. Nobody's putting their camera on them because they're not tearing down a building and they're not shouting names and they're not on Twitter. They're just solving problems together.
So yeah, just as a follow-up question, Michael, if you don't mind, with AllSides.com, the top two stories are Trump's campaign, election lawsuits, and Biden is the projected winner. And from the right, both of those stories is Fox News. And then from the left, campaign, election lawsuits is from Salon. And then the other one is from AP. And then, of course, from the center, you have Axios and USA Today. What do you think about how Fox sits in on the news, especially since it seems to only lean right?
Well, it's almost inevitable in our capitalist media culture that you're going to end up with a network that specializes in being liberal and a network that specializes in being conservative. Do I find it sad? Yes. Do I find it a very unnutritional civic diet? Yes. But it's almost inevitable that you're going to have that. So what John Gable tried to do, and I'm so grateful, Maria, that you're fast. You went straight to the site and looked around. I appreciate that. What he's trying to do, he's trying to say, you know, let's have a nutritious diet, you know, and your nutritious diet is not all meat or not all vegetables or not all grains. You know, have a nutritious diet. And John believes that a nutritious diet is getting your information from the right, the left, and the center. And I totally agree with him. I mean, I'm not a Fox News fan, I'm really grateful that Fox exists, because Fox gives a voice to the news that a lot of other networks have been neglecting. And I think that's a useful function. If somebody says to me, I get all of my news from Fox, I basically say to them, you're going to not end up a very healthy citizen because you're not getting a nutritious diet. And I'll recommend that they watch something else. In fact, one of my closing recommendations in the United States, Maria, is in the book is, you know, diversify your diet. And if you're used to reading and consuming only conservative stuff, take a vacation, and listen to some liberal news and read some liberal sources and vice versa. I think it's a tremendously useful tool, if only because it'll help you talk to the other side better. And we've almost lost that capacity now. And unfortunately, the president who's, you know, has been modeling a kind of behavior in which, you know, you don't really talk to the other side, you don't really listen to the other side. And I'm hoping that Joe Biden brings a different style, one that actually listens, one that actually pays attention. If he wants to get anything done, he has no choice.
You know, and then and one more question, Michael, if you don't mind, because otherwise it would be tangential. So, Mark, I've been trained as a therapist as well. And what you just mentioned about people consuming a diet of that of which they know, we know in psychology is called confirmation bias. Do you want to share with our listeners what that means and how that's probably not healthy?
Yeah, confirmation bias, I think, was a term. When I researched the origins of the term, the term developed in the 60s by social scientists. And it basically means that if you think Biden is a crook, you will then proceed to find information and get websites and so forth that confirm your notion that Biden is a crook. And if you think Trump is mentally ill and a psychopath, you will quickly find sources of information that confirm that he's mentally ill and is a psychopath. And confirmation bias is something that in the previous era, as citizens, we couldn't do. Because when Walter Cronkite came on, Walter Cronkite said what Walter Cronkite wanted to say, and we had to listen to him whether we agreed with him or not. Whereas now, we don't have to listen to Walter Cronkite. If we can go to that network that's going to tell us only what we want to hear, and whether that's MSNBC or Fox, we can keep feeding ourselves the same diet, and that's confirmation bias, and it's a dangerous thing, and it's why the founding fathers made public education part of our society, because they knew we needed to be educated, and educated did not mean getting all your news from a single source.
Thank you.
You know the internet exacerbates that tremendously. I've always believed that people, rather than going out and looking for the truth, go out and look for things that confirm their biases. And you can find it on the internet. I don't care what you think. There's somebody on the internet that agrees with you. So, that's a really, really important thing these days. Let me tell you, I heard John Meacham say, the famous historian today, say that we've always been divided. He brings up the Civil War, the 1960s, and several other examples from American history about how we've always been divided. And he says that division brings about great change historically, that it uncovers the commonality that we have. And that moves us forward. What do you think about that?
Well, we have always been divided, and I think we always will be divided. That's why our motto is E Pluribus Unum, out of many one. We'll always be many, and we'll be many races, we'll be many political philosophies, we'll be some people who lean more towards, you know, government activism, and some who want a smaller government. We'll always have these differences. They're not going to go away.
But the good news that this will move us forward?
I was going to say, that back in the 90s, when I was doing the retreats, people would say, oh, we've always had differences. You know, we've always had differences, and these are just the same differences as always. Now, there's almost nobody you can find who will say that the tone of our politics has not gotten more negative, more coarse, and more divided. There's never an election anymore which is a landslide, where the country agrees that they want a Reagan or that they want a Clinton. Now we're always razor thin. If you look at the margins, it was divided absolutely down the middle. And as you can see from the polling, now people say, I can't trust anybody from the other party. And there's even people who say, I don't want my children to marry anybody from the other party. It's almost replacing race. Political affiliation is almost replacing race. We almost have something called partyism now. As racism hopefully declines, we're now increasing something called partyism. And so I think it's gotten worse, and that the proof is the proof is we don't accomplish anything anymore. I mean, Obama will work hard to get a health care passed, and then Trump will spend 4 years trying to undo it. And it didn't used to be like that. When, you know, the Social Security lasted for, you know, Social Security wasn't changed every 4 years. And that's why the system has worked and stood by us. So I think things are getting worse. And I think they're, to me, the critical moment that I experienced it getting worse was when a chief of staff in the House of Representatives came up to me after I'd facilitated one of the retreats. And she whispered, because she didn't want anybody to know she was telling me. She said, Mark, she said, do you know that the Democratic Party leader has told all of us that we need to oppose everything that the Republicans propose? And they've told their people to oppose everything that we propose. She said, yeah. I don't think that's leadership, Mark. What do you think? And it was this moment I'll never forget, because she was really saying, we've stopped trying to solve problems. We're now just trying to outscore the other side. And she was noticing 20 years ago that was changing. It's only gotten worse. It's only gotten worse. And that's not leadership. She was right. That is not leadership. And I think you probably both agree.
Yeah, I do agree. And I think that we're seeing it, again, to use your sports analogy, we're seeing it everywhere. We're even, you know, underinflated footballs, guys thrown out for a baseball for spying on the other team. I mean, it seems to be a national plague. But let me ask you, going back to something you said before, which I think is so important, when you were given the examples of the people in your film, there's a guy here in Washington named Reverend Hagler, and he was called in to be a mediator in a strike in Smithfield, Virginia, where Mexican Americans mostly and black people were at each other's throats in the actually there had been killings in the meatpacking industry. And Hagler went down there, and what he did was he had dinners, exactly what you're talking about. He had dinners with the workers, the Spanish-speaking workers in the plant, and the African-Americans. And he convinced them that they had a common goal. And the enemy wasn't the other side. The enemy was the people that ran the meatpacking facility. So he got them together. I think that's a great idea. But what and the things you're talking about are also along the same lines, a great idea. But what policies can we put in place as a government that facilitates that sort of thing so that we don't have to do it on such a small scale? We can figure out a way to do it on a larger scale. Since you have, in fact, done it on a larger scale, what can we do as a government?
Well, you've asked the $64,000 question, Michael, because after we did the second retreat, we proposed that there be an office of facilitation in the House of Representatives. Because why did we propose that? Because we had just had a session of Congress in which Newt Gingrich, who was then the majority leader, and Dick Kiphart, the minority leader, had not talked to each other for 18 months. Now, they only served for 24 months. They hadn't talked to each other for 18 months. And so we thought, okay, if literally the two people who were supposed to collaborate in the People's House of Representatives, they're not talking to each other, we need an office of facilitation that can say, you know, arrange a meeting, arrange some kind of way around whatever the impasse is. And guess who opposed the development of an office of facilitation? Newt Gingrich and Dick Gephardt.
Yeah,
why?
Of course.
Because they have the power. And an office of facilitation would take away their power. So my colleague William Urey, who wrote Getting to Yes, calls this the third side, that your question, Michael, really goes to the heart of the problem structurally, which is if you have two parties and they're at war with each other, who has the power to bring them together and say, let's work this out? Where's the third side? And the truth is the third side are the American people. It's the American people who have to decide that they don't want red warriors and blue warriors running the country. They have to decide that they want people who solve problems. Now, some of them will wear red and some of them will wear blue and maybe some of them will wear another color like green or yellow. But we need people who want to solve problems, and the American people have to start electing them. And we have not been doing that. We've been preferring warriors who are warriors of the right or warriors of the left. And I don't mind people standing up for what they believe. I mean, that's great. But ultimately, if you're not going to work with the other side, either you're going to fail altogether or you'll get something passed when you're in the majority. And as soon as you're in the minority, it'll get taken apart again. And so if you want to have an enduring impact on the quality of life for Americans and solve problems, you have to be a warrior and a weaver, you know, a warrior and a weaver who weaves with the other side and actually gets the job done. So,
I'm sorry, Mark. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You go ahead.
So should we rate people on this? Should we do what the NRA and the, you know, other lobby groups do, where they give you a rating on how good you are on their issues? Should there be a friendship, or a part, you know, a get along? Should we have somebody that can rate how well politicians are working together? Should we do that?
We could, but it would obviously be a very contentious and argumentative process, because people would disagree about it. My feeling is, just when you have two candidates running for an office, look at which one of them has gotten more done for you. Look at which one of them has gotten more collaboration from their side. Look at which one speaks about the other side with respect and looks like they might actually accomplish something. I'll use Bernie Sanders as an example. I love Bernie Sanders. I think he's a wonderful guy. I think he's a charming fellow. I really admire his stamina. I love his passion for his point of view. I really do. But do I think Bernie Sanders as president would get a lot done? Nope. I don't think he would, because he does not have a history of collaboration. He turns people off who disagree with him. He tends to be very strident and committed to his point of view in a very and do I think he's right about a lot of things? I happen to agree with him about a lot of things, but will he get it done? No, he won't. And so, you know, for me, I'm much more interested in people who will actually get things done. You know, so I think what I call them transpartisan Republicans and transpartisan Democrats. You know, the ones who are willing to work with people on the other side, the ones who have an ounce of humility, who say, I don't have the complete and total answer to this problem. And take immigration. You know, I mean, do I think the right or the left has a monopoly on what to do about immigration? No. It's a balancing act. It's a balancing act about borders that are open to people, but not so open that you become flooded and out of control. It has to be open to immigration and open to change and open to helping people who are seeking asylum. But it also has to have some kind of ground rules and some kind of, you know, fencing, so that it's not just a free-for-all. So almost every issue, I mean, gun control, which I've studied very, very closely. I mean, if the left says, you know, I mean, I'll say these, you know, cliches, people say, well, there should be no guns at all on school property, no guns anywhere near a school. All guns should be far away from these. Well, that makes basically saying the school is vulnerable to anybody who comes in with a gun, which is what they do. And if somebody says, well, there should be guns everywhere, you know, the janitor should have a gun, the bus driver should have a gun, the principal should have a gun, the teacher should have a gun, I'm going, oh my God, it's going to be one accident after another. So it's the almost every issue, when you look at it, as much as I respect people who are arguing the left and right position, they're not problem solvers. They're not problem solvers. They're not really trying to make their kids safer at school tomorrow. And when I facilitate conversations in the communities around this, I say, do you want your children safer at school tomorrow than they are today? Well, if so, you're going to have to work together. And if you don't work together, it means you care more about being right than you do about your kids being safe. And I look them straight in the eye when I say that, you know, because they have to then look in their own hearts and say, I really do want my kids to be safer tomorrow. And that's, to me, the great hope for America, is that we realize we want our kids to be safer tomorrow. We want them to be better fed. We want them to be better educated. We want them to have better health care. We want them to give work in a country that's at peace. And if we really love our children, we really love our country, we'll wake up and snap out of this hyper-partisan warfare.
Before I let Marie ask you the next question, let me also just point out that we had Harry Jaffe, who's a journalist on the show that wrote a book about Bernie Sanders, a guy that I love too, and he said exactly what you just said. Uh-huh. I mean, he said that was his assessment. He liked Bernie too, but he said that was exactly the same assessment that he had of Bernie. Go ahead, Marie. I'm sorry.
It's okay. So I wanted to follow up on both Michael and Mark, a comment that you made about the confirmation bias and looking for the information that you already believe and finding that the algorithms and the artificial intelligence and social media are programmed to do that. So that depending on your clicks and your views and how long and how many likes and et cetera, your feed then is populated by those right. items that you already ascribe to. So it's not like it's happening by design. And I don't know if everybody knows that. I just wanted to make that statement. But I wanted to ask you, Mark, there's a thinking, and I'd like you to clarify for our listeners between meditation and mindfulness, but mm-hmm. about bringing mindfulness into politics and what that looks like to you and how you could describe that to our listeners.
Well, Maria, that's a beautiful question. What I would encourage people to do who are interested in really going deep into that question would be to read the book by an Ohio congressman called A Mindful Nation. Are you familiar with that, Maria?
I am not.
There's actually an Ohio congressman. I'm forgetting his name for a moment. He comes from the Akron area. He's a Democrat. He ran briefly for president and decided not to. But he wrote a book called A Mindful Nation, and he basically said he'd studied a lot with Jon Kabat-Zinn, and he'd been a meditator. And as a multi-term congressman, he realized, you know, mindfulness is actually would make our prison system better. Mindfulness would make our education system better. Mindfulness would make our healthcare system better. And what he really was saying is he was saying it more from a mindfulness perspective. I'm saying it more from a psychological perspective, is that we need to bring a different consciousness to our politics. And I think politics is all about attaching to a point of view, you know, like I'm pro-life or I'm pro-choice. We attach to those points of view, whereas meditation is about witnessing and stepping back from attachment. It's about non-attachment. So I almost consider meditation to be the antidote to partisanship, because if you do that, if you step back from the partisanship, you realize, oh, well, there's some truth on this side. Oh, and there's some truth on that side. And oh, those are good people on that side. And oh, those are good people on that side. But they differ about the means for achieving the end. And you're able to actually hold them both in your heart at the same time. And that's, to me, the exercise. If I were to suggest people an exercise, when you see a Democrat or Republican arguing about XYZ on television or in your own community, practice holding them both in your own heart and see what happens. To me, it's one of the most illuminating meditations possible. But why don't you say something more about that, Marie, if you have another thought, because I have a feeling you had something in mind when you asked the question.
Well, just as an aside to our listeners, Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn founded a mindfulness-based stress reduction practice, and he's also in pain management through mindfulness, and as you beautifully said, is about being in the moment. And it, I guess they call it MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, yes. But Tim Ryan is the author that you were
That's
mentioning.
Right. That's
yes,
right.
And so you did joggle my mind about that.
Yeah. And in fact, Tim Ryan started the Mindful Nation Foundation, and you can find out more about his work through that and read his book. It's very powerful. And for me, in the United States of America, when I talk about being a learner and learning as the first core principle of being a citizen, you can't learn without taking kind of a more mindful approach, because if you barrel into a conversation, which is I'm right, and whatever the other person says that disagrees with me, they're wrong, and I'm not going to listen to them. That's not mindfulness. That's mindlessness.
And so they say the solution with mindfulness, and I pronounce this better than I can, Lao Tzu said, watch your thoughts, they become your words. Watch your words, they become your actions. Watch your actions, they become your habits. Watch your habits, they become your character. Watch your character, it becomes your destiny.
Beautiful.
And that's what I was thinking about mindfulness and politics. If we could put more of that in there, I think that's where we would get more morality and integrity and character that to President-elect Joe Biden's cause has said that that's what he wants to restore, that I do believe we've lost as a country somewhat.
I believe so too, but the challenge that I think we face is that in my book, I quote every president from George W. Bush to Clinton to Obama, all of them, back to Reagan and Clinton. I quote all of them saying, I'm going to be a uniter, not a divider, or I'm not president of the red states, the blue states, I'm president of the United States, or, you know, it's not about left and right, it's about going forward or going back. And all of them have rhetorically said they want to bridge the divide, and all of them have failed. And I think that's something we need to look at as a nation, that we need to hold these two things. In one hand, we need to hold that we're at war with each other, we're divided, we're opponents. And on the other hand, we're all Americans, we're in this together. And I, as I mentioned, the two hands, I often, when I'm speaking in front of an audience in the old days before COVID, I would put both my hands in front of me. I'd say, how many of you want to live your life with two hands? And then I'd put one hand behind my back and I'd say, how many of you would rather live your life with just one hand? I said, well, I have a left hand and a right hand. And I've got a left eye and a right eye. I've got a left ear and a right ear. I said, I'm a walking example of transpartisan politics, and so are you. So if, you know, why is it so hard for us to imagine that the left and right in the body politic are supposed to work together? You know, I mean, before I came on the show with you guys, you know, I was buttoning my shirt and I was realizing, well, you know, I'm using two hands to button my shirt. It's really hard to button your shirt with one hand, you know.
By itself,
and so,
yes.
So that's why, for me, the fact that America has a left hand and a right hand, I consider that as a strength for America. But I think the challenge, and this is where, you know, mindfulness comes in, to understand that, you have to look beyond the quarrel. You have to look beyond the fight. You have to hold people in your heart and say, you know, they're decent people, they're caring people, and somehow or other they've ended up on opposite sides of the fence. How can I play a role in taking down that fence and getting them to work together? And I think we've reached the point as a nation now where, I mean, just take example of foreign interference in our elections. If there's anything that you should unite us as Americans, it's making sure that Russians and Iranians and Chinese and others do not meddle in our election. I mean, if you think about it, it's like, I mean, that should unite us if nothing else does. And so there's an example of what I would call an urgent and pressing need. You know, a quarter of a million people dying of COVID, and another quarter of a million predicted to die in the coming year. I mean, that should unite us as a nation. That's not a small problem, you know. That should unite us. And so there's so many things now that, you know, watching fires ravage California at a rate that are unprecedented, watching hurricanes, 28 in one hurricane season, ravage the south coast of the United States, watching floods that we've never seen before, that should unite us as a nation, you know. And can you still disagree about climate change? Sure, disagree about it, but agree that you want to start taking steps to make the country safer and to deal with these increasing frequency of major climate events. These are all things that should unite us if we can step into that more mindful space, Maria, that you're talking about.
Beautiful.
Well, we're out of time, guys. I can't believe it. It went by quickly. Obviously, we've got much more to talk about. So, Mark Gerzin, you've been a great guest. I hope you'll come back sometime and we can continue the conversation before
especially after the feature film.
Yes, especially after the film. And please give people your website again.
Yes, to find out more about the film, go to reunitedstates.tv. And to find out more about me, go to mediatorsfoundation.org.
Well, Mark Gerzin, thank you so much. And we always dedicate a song at the end of the show to our guest. And tonight, here's one from the Young Bloods, Get Together. It's a classic. Just like
thank you,
Mark.
Both. Thanks. Thank you both
thank
for
you,
inviting
Mark.
Me on. It's great
continued
to be with you.
Success.
Absolutely.
And to you.
Love is but a song we sing, fears we will die.
You can make representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.